Support for Yale Cancer Answers is provided by AstraZeneca, working to change the cancer paradigm through personalized medicine. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com. Welcome to Yale Cancer Answers with Drs. Howard Hochster, Anish Chagpar, and Stephen Gore. I'm Bruce Barber. Yale Cancer Answers is our way of providing you with the most up-to-date information on cancer care by welcoming oncologists and specialists who are on the forefront of the battle to fight cancer. This week, it's a conversation about research myths in mainstream media with Dr. Perry Wilson. Dr. Wilson is an assistant professor of medicine at Yale School of Medicine, and Dr. Gore is a professor of internal medicine and hematology and director of hematologic malignancies at Smilow Cancer Hospital.
Myths. What's a myth?
So what I like to talk about a lot is how the popular media portrays medical research. So I'm a medical researcher myself. I think medical research is this amazing thing and a high expression of the scientific method.
That sounds like a myth to me.
In some cases, it is. How the media conveys scientific research is filled with a lot of myths. And I'm not talking about myths like people only use 10% of their brain. I mean, those things are out there. What I mean is how scientific research gets done and how the popular press tends to sensationalize the research that's out there.
Could you give me an example?
There are so many examples.
Let's start with one.
There are so many examples. We'll see a study, for instance. I have one that I liked where it was a large study in China, about 600,000 people involved. And what they found was that people who said they ate chili powder more often lived slightly longer.
Okay.
And this was all over. This was in the New York Times, on ABC News, and basically, you know, spicy food's the key to longevity is how that gets promoted.
I'll go with that.
Yeah, it would be nice. I like spicy food myself. When you dug into the actual study, you'd find a number of things. Number one, you'd find that in China, it turns out that spicy food is distributed very regionally, and particular rural people were more likely to eat more spicy food, which was not fully accounted for. The other thing you'd find out is that the effect size that they were talking about, the amount that it would increase your life, was incredibly small. So small, in fact, that you would have to take roughly 6,000 people and put them on a spicy food diet to save one life over 100 years. So just an incredibly of passing interest to those of us who enjoy spicy food.
But not really relevant.
But not changing the world, right? And I think the most disappointing part of that study was that the effect was only seen in people who don't drink alcohol. Now, I don't know if you're like me, but if I'm having something spicy, you know, a little bit of beer on the side really helps. So
I'm not going to weigh in on that one.
So we see that very often. You sort of take the headline from the study without diving a little deeper. And particularly studies that show very modest effects, it's rarely mentioned that those effects are so modest.
Yeah. So who has responsibility for this, right? I mean, the media is trying to sell their newspaper or their website, right? That's what they do for advertising, yeah. Whatever. That, you know, they need that, and they need to put stuff out there that is of interest to people, and people seem to be interested in ways of improving their health.
Yeah.
So, I mean, do you think the media has a responsibility for doing the kind of deep dive? I mean, you know, there's people like Dr. Sanjay Gupta and stuff who I think are trying to be pretty responsible,
absolutely,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, there are some great science journalists out there. And to some extent, the answer is yes. You know, journalism is journalism. And obviously, people want to generate clicks and website visits and things like that. But we would, you know, never expect our political journalists to not sort of dig a little bit deeper when a scandal breaks.
I don't know about that. It sounds like fake news.
We would ask more of them. And I think the good science journalists out there really do that. There aren't many of them. Not that there aren't many good science journalists, but there aren't many science journalists, period. Because unfortunately, especially in print media, we've seen less and less profits. They've cut back on staff. So dedicated science journalists are a rare thing. But to some extent, you need those people because they're the ones who actually understand how to read a study and aren't just going off the press release.
Right. And what about scientific literacy among the lay community who's reading this? Do you think that, you know, you just talked a lot rather simply, which I appreciate, but talked about a big sample size and a small effect size. And, you know, and I certainly get what that means. And I think many of our listeners do, too.
Sure.
But do you think that the lay public can get beyond the headline, even if the Sanjay Guptas in the world try to explain this? Do we have enough scientific literacy to have this be part of our conversation?
I have a lot of faith in the public that are.
I'm not trying to put anyone down.
No, of course not. No, and that are reading these studies. I think with a couple of sort of simple tricks, we can vastly increase the scientific literacy. So one thing I tell my patients, and I'm sure like you, I have patients that come in after having looked on Google or
sure.
about a disease or a treatment. They come in all the time. A couple of simple rules of thumb I tell my patients. Number one is that no single study is enough. And much of the science news, the medical news that comes out, is about a single study. That's just the nature of the news cycle. Something gets published and we're going to talk about it. Those single studies, we shouldn't go off of. Please read the article, be interested, kind of keep it in the back of your head. Oh, chili powder, I'm going to keep an eye out for that.
Talk to your doctor about it.
Talk to your doctor about it, absolutely. But one study's never enough. The second thing is this concept that I like to get into people's heads, which is, how many people do you need to treat with this drug to benefit one person? That has a technical name. It's called the number needed to treat. But if a patient just asks that question to their doctor, how many people need to be treated with this drug to benefit one person, they will be very surprised by the answer more often than not.
Do you think most doctors can answer that question?
Most doctors should have the ability to answer that question with a quick internet search of the relevant studies.
Okay.
That is, and if they don't, they should learn. I think it's a critical part of medical education is to know how to read the medical literature. And we're seeing more and more of that in medical schools, and I'm encouraged by that. But if patients look, they can even go to certain websites. There's a great website called thennt.com, the number needed to treat, thennt.com.
N-N-T, okay.
Yeah. And that site just lists medical studies and tells you how many people need to be treated with this drug to benefit one person. And you'll see numbers that will shock you. You'll see numbers like 200, 1,000, 5,000. And when you realize that, a drug might, you have to give a drug to 100 people to prevent one person from dying, you ask a whole new interesting series of questions. Now, it doesn't mean the drug doesn't work or that the drug's not good. In fact, if the drug is relatively harmless or has very little side effects and isn't crazy expensive, then that might be a totally reasonable proposition to treat 100 people to save one life. But you can imagine situations, obviously, where that's not reasonable. And that's a key to really having an informed discussion with your doctor about taking a medication.
Yeah, but let me just push back a little bit. But from my perspective, what patients are interested in is not so much how many patients are needed to be treated to see a statistical effect, but what are my chances of benefiting from this thing, me?
Yeah.
Right? It's all about me, which is appropriate, right?
Well,
so how do you invert that?
Very simply. If 100 patients need to be treated for one to see an effect, the chance that it will benefit you is 1%. And again, we might say, oh, that's crazy, but if it's a once a day kind of vitamin or something, then you might, and it's preventing death, well, then yeah, maybe I'll take that 1% chance that I'm the one in 100 people. But what it'll also do is force you to have a conversation with your doctor about your individual risk.
Right.
Right? Because those studies present the data from a whole population, the average. On average, it benefits people, 1% of the time. But you might be significantly higher, particularly if your risk of that outcome is much higher. If your risk of death is much higher, well, maybe that vitamin is much more effective in you.
It's really interesting. Last night, I happened to be out for dinner with a couple of friends. One's a lawyer and one's an engineer. They're both very intelligent people. And we were at a sort of a health food oriented kind of place that happened to have like an emporium upstairs. And the emporium, I was just amazed at the number of supplements. I mean, I guess I shouldn't have been surprised, but there were just rows and rows of supplements. And I brought this up at dinner, and one of my friends was saying, well, he really, wants to start taking B vitamins. B complex. I said, oh, why? And he started listing these things that he thought B complex vitamins did. And I just commented to him. I said, well, you know, you seem to eat a pretty healthy diet. I'm sure you're not deficient in any B vitamins. And we had a reasonable conversation about it, but I could tell that he wasn't interested in hearing that, right? He wanted to believe that B vitamins were going to do whatever it was he wanted. And I find that true with a lot of very educated people. There's this belief system, and I'm not putting anybody down about it, about untested supplements in particular. Mm-hmm. What's your experience or thoughts about that?
Absolutely. And
turmeric powder.
Oh, yeah.
Milk thistle.
I'm a kidney doctor. We just had a
coenzyme
very...
Q. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of this. We just had a negative study for turmeric powder. So people fall into Google holes all the time. The technical term for this is confirmation bias, where you Google, you know, B vitamin health benefits.
Right.
And
you find some.
You're going to find an awful lot. And so you can get this. You can get in this really self-reinforcing area. You're correct. It is really hard to disabuse people of some of these notions. The best thing to do is often just to suggest other methods of search. Hey, have you checked out, you know, this website, and if you're interested, I can give you some very authoritative websites that look at things like this. But have you checked out this? You know, they have some great information. Let people discover the alternative information themselves rather than, you know, sort of beating them over
Preachy.
The head with it. Now, there's some cases where, you know, a lot of doctors will say, you know, he wants to take a B vitamin.
Sure.
Not going to hurt, you know.
Totally.
I'm a nephrologist. I'm a kidney doctor. We say vitamins give you expensive pee. You know, they just kind of get peed out. It's fine.
I tried that one too.
You know, what's the harm? And there probably is a little harm to your pocketbook, but that's okay. In some cases, though, people are forgoing, you know, what we'd call more conventional therapy. And you know, you can think of some high-profile cases like Steve Jobs where—
He didn't get treated for his pancreas cancer.
Exactly. And in those situations, I think as medical professionals, you actually do have a bit more of a role to ensure that if they're taking the vitamins, that's fine. But let's not forget to take your other medication as well.
Yeah, well, you know, I have to say that I was a little humbled a year or two ago when a patient of mine who may or may not have had a particular kind of low-grade leukemia that I treat, you know, declined my recommendation, or he tried it one day, and he had a real big list of these things, including milk thistle and all this other stuff. I can't tell you what milk thistle is. And for whatever reason, his counts got better. Now, maybe he really had a... you know, a transient viral thing or whatever, but he's a believer, and I can't disabuse him because, well, you know, he's better. True and unrelated, or true? I don't know.
It can be very hard to tell. Fortunately, we do have an apparatus to test these things. We have things called randomized trials where we can evaluate whether drugs work and whether supplements work. The supplement companies are not terribly interested in doing this because I don't think they stand to gain very much by doing a trial. It either turns out to be negative and there's some evidence against them, and they're already getting people to buy them. So unfortunately, we don't see as much of that as we should.
Right. And it's not easy to get such studies funded all the time either if you're an academic wanting to do them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Grant funding is an issue. I wish the...
It's expensive to do these trials.
It can be incredibly expensive. The average clinical trial of a new therapeutic, well, this is if you're trying to get FDA approval, I think the most recent estimate was $50 million. That money
doesn't... It's a little more than I have.
Yeah, a little bit more, despite our Yale salaries, right? But nevertheless, there are ways to do these studies, you know, especially supplements don't need FDA approval, that are much cheaper.
Well, Perry, this is really fascinating topic, and we're going to want to continue about this, but right now, we need to take a short break for a medical minute and for me to take all my supplements. Please stay tuned to learn more information on media myths.
Support for Yale Cancer Answers is provided by AstraZeneca, a biopharmaceutical business with a deep-rooted heritage in oncology and a commitment to developing cancer medicines for patients. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com. The American Cancer Society estimates that over 1,500 people will be diagnosed with colorectal cancer in Connecticut this year. When detected early, colorectal cancer is easily treated and highly curable, and as a result, it's recommended that men and women over the age of 50 have regular colonoscopies to screen for the disease. Tumor gene analysis has helped improve management of colorectal cancer by identifying the patients most likely to benefit from chemotherapy and newer targeted agents, resulting in more patient-specific treatments. This has been a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center and Smilow Cancer Hospital. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Answers. This is Dr. Stephen Gore, and I'm joined tonight by my guest, Dr. Perry Wilson from the Yale School of Medicine, and we are talking about myths about medicine and supplements and other health issues in the media and how people respond to them. Perry, one thing that I'm not sure how it fits into the myth thing, but one of the frequent complaints you hear from colleagues, friends, and patients is the frequently changing recommendations, dietary recommendations often, based on this new clinical study versus that old clinical study. So coffee causes pancreatic cancer, coffee prevents pancreatic cancer, yeah. Something's good for your blood pressure, something's bad for your blood pressure, you should take this for your cholesterol, no, you should do this diet instead. And there's a lot of exhaustion around that, and of course people are scurrying around, but you know, what do you think about that?
This is a major issue for patients, especially when the media is reporting kind of breathlessly about the newest study. And coffee always seems to just get a lot of attention, I think, because it's such a delicious and good thing.
You don't think Starbucks is paying for that?
That we all love. I haven't seen Starbucks directly financing any of this research. Dietary research is. You know, I don't mean to be overly critical here, but is its own circle of hell in my opinion. So much of dietary research relies on something called the food frequency questionnaire. And basically what you do is you give a patient this 100 questions that says, how often do you eat meat? How often do you eat smoked meat? How often do you eat soft cheeses? How often do you eat hard cheeses? On and on and on. This is a huge amount of data for each patient. And now you can take all that and put it in a computer, and you can dice that any way you want. You can look at each individual question, you know, soft cheese as it relates to lung cancer, or you can say, well, soft cheese has lactose, so let's combine all the things that have lactose in it and relate that to lung cancer, or you can say, well, total calories, and you can cut this data in a million different ways. That's very dangerous, because the more times you can test a hypothesis, the more likely you are to get it wrong, which is why I think we see all these back and forth about dietary research. You know, coffee, you know, people say the coffee effect, and there's a lot of research. When I like to point out, you know, some people have their coffee black. Some people have, you know, a double tall mocha frappuccino with extra sugar. And
that's not coffee.
I highly doubt that those have the same effects. In addition, you know, coffee, just black coffee, has hundreds of different chemicals in it, right? So we have no idea what's going on there. The coffee effect may as easily be the biscotti effect, because we're just picking up patterns of behavior.
The oatmeal effect, maybe.
The oatmeal effect, right? There's or the working effect, right? So people who work more or have more intense jobs may drink more coffee.
And they may have more stress.
They may have more stress as well. So there's a lot of these things playing. And unfortunately, these observational studies just never capture all of that. So I hesitate a lot when any new diet fad comes out and promotes long-lasting health benefits. To the credit of some of the societies out there that make recommendations, they tend to slow walk these things a little bit. It took a long time for the American Heart Association to sort of evaluate how much salt is appropriate in the diet, and they're still evaluating, but they don't change with every single study. The news media would like us to believe that oh, now eggs are good for you, now eggs are bad for you.
Oh, yeah, that was a big one. Eggs and cholesterol, right?
Yeah, yeah. There are some broad trends that I think are very true. So I think the shift away from, you know, fat as a danger and more towards simple carbohydrates as a danger seems to be supported by more and more evidence. But again, we have to be very careful. We have to be slow. We need a lot of studies saying the same thing. Any given study you see, even, you know, in the venerable New York Times, you got to take with a grain of salt. But not
or
more
sugar.
Than, not more than 2,500 milligrams a day.
Well, no, I had this in my life, just an internist that I used in Baltimore when I lived there, who's a great guy, had me taking fish oil because there was heart disease in my family and stuff. Yep. And I had a little bit of a, not a cholesterol problem, but a subtype of cholesterol problem. And then the fish oil data kind of turned out to be not as convincing, mm-hmm. to say the least. And yeah. and I threw away a big bottle of fish oil capsules, which is fine because it's kind of yuck anyway.
But. Right. Well, we also have to explain to patients that science is supposed to change. We're supposed to kind of keep testing things and reevaluating things. And so I would be very worried if we'd be treating the same condition with the same medicine for 100 years. That's sort of a bad sign. We're not making progress there. So I don't think patients should sort of distrust the medical profession when we say, you know what, we got some new data and we thought this drug worked, but the better data suggests it doesn't. There's some really dramatic examples of that. There was a drug called flecainide, which was used to suppress abnormal heart rhythms. And 20 years ago or so, it was known that after people have a heart attack, these abnormal heart rhythms precede death. And
right.
the thought was, they're going to have this abnormal rhythm and then they die. This drug suppressed those abnormal rhythms and it did it beautifully. It worked very well. So for some period of time, we were treating patients with this. Then the longer term studies showed that the use of that drug was associated with a threefold higher risk of death.
Wow.
And so we don't use it anymore. Now, this was not the medical profession being bought out by big pharma. This is how research works. You have initial studies that look at an important outcome like the rate of abnormal heart rhythms, and then you have longer term, more comprehensive studies that look at a really important outcome like death. And we should expect things to change. I gave you a notable example where it really went wrong.
And Vioxx, right?
Well, that's another great example where more information came out. Now, Vioxx, in contrast, does seem to some of that information that we should have had initially may not have come out when it should have. And that is a major problem, obviously.
Well, let's talk about that. So yeah. People may not remember, but Vioxx was an arthritis drug or an anti-inflammatory. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Uh-huh. And it was supposed to be safer or better than things like Advil?
Yeah, maybe less risk of gastrointestinal bleeding, which was a rare complication of some of those other drugs. Yeah.
All right, so can you remind us what the problem was?
Well, the data showed, sure enough, it was very effective in terms of pain control, and people had a lot of benefit in terms of their arthritis symptoms. But the longer-term data showed that it increased the risk of heart attacks and other blood clotting problems.
Mm.
And had that long-term data come out with long-term follow-up, careful surveillance as we do of a lot of drugs, that would be one thing. But the lawsuits allege and that the maker of Vioxx, which is
Merck,
I believe, was actually aware of some of those complications beforehand. Now, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't want to get into that too much. But that is, that we would call a failure of the system. But the existence of occasional failures like that does not necessarily, shouldn't discount the whole process, because by and large, medical research is methodical, slow, and accurate. Reporting on medical research is not.
So why do you think people in the public, there's so many people who kind of believe that the cure to cancer is known, and somehow physicians don't want to tell people that they aren't willing to test the special berries or
yeah.
whatever. Why is there this mistrust?
I think some of the mistrust is rooted in history. There are some notable ethical failures in the history of medical research. You think of the Tuskegee experiments where, deliberately infecting people with syphilis or not treating them with syphilis, things like that did happen in the
Terrible,
past.
Terrible, yes.
There are a variety of ethical and legal obligations we have now conducting human research that we don't have then, which is very important. So there is that kind of backdrop. The other thing is that people really want there to be a cure for cancer. Cancer is scary. And we all know someone who's had cancer, and most of us probably know someone who's died of cancer. And just knowing that it's out there is frightening. And it's very reassuring to think that there's a cure. What I tell people when they tell me, oh, you guys know what the cure to cancer is, especially as a struggling assistant professor here at Yale, if I had the cure to cancer,
why would I withhold that?
They could not pay me enough to, shout it from the rooftops and be the most famous, physician scientist in the history of mankind. It's just that type of conspiracy is a little too difficult for me to swallow.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yesterday I was offering a clinical trial to a patient where I really thought it was, probably her best option at this time. And I, of course, discussed other options. And she had a cousin with her, you know, nice person. And you know, I'm very careful about going through the consent form with the patient when I have time to do so, because I think our consent forms tend to be very difficult for most people to read, even though they're supposed to be at a lay level. They're very hard, and there's so much information there from the lawyers that I like to just kind of look at paragraph four.
Yeah,
you can take the whole thing home and read it, but this is what
that's how I do it. Anyway. Yeah, sure.
So I went through that, and you know, and of course, it talks about, you know, one of the investigators has a conflict of interest that he discloses because he consults for the pharma company that makes it, And the cousin said, although she wasn't discouraging the patient from going on, it was like, well, you know, it's all about the money. And, you know, they should be paying you to be on this to be a guinea pig. I was very disturbed that that was her response, but I also kind of got it, you know.
I get it. It's in the pharmaceutical industry is, you know, a multi-hundred billion dollar industry. Pharmaceutical companies are profitable. They charge a lot for their medications. They do have a vested interest
in a positive result.
In a positive result. The nice thing is that we have this governmental institution called the FDA, which is going to pour through their data and make sure that they didn't cook the books at all. That is the public's voice in this process. And to date, the FDA has been an incredible advocate for public health and public safety. In fact, to the point where some people complain that they're not approving drugs fast enough. So, you know, fortunately, we have a watchdog group there. And I think that's very important that that we explain that to patients.
Do you think that physicians who participate in these studies have some complicity? I'm not sure what the word is, you know, kind of look the other way or allow statements to be made? How often do you think that happens, that they're not? Do you have any sense?
Allow statements to be made about a drug that turn out not to be true, or that
the data maybe are interpreted. How complicit do you think the physicians are when there's been?
Yeah,
you know
that's interesting.
I mean, because we are the authors of these articles, right? Even though the pharma company is sponsoring it.
Yeah, in some cases.
Oftentimes.
Yeah. Oftentimes. Yeah. Personally, I'll just say that my research funding comes from the NIH. So, but I think that once a study is published. And a physician is out there discussing the results. I think there is a human tendency to put the best light on that, because none of us are going to sign up to do a clinical trial, to run a clinical trial that we don't believe in to some extent.
Right. So there's an impetus to be right, to look good.
You know, if someone came to me and said, you know, I want to do a trial of slapping people in the head to see if it cures cancer and I'll give you all this money to do it, I would still say, no, you know, I don't think that's going to work. And so.
But it might work for kidney failure.
Maybe, yeah. Well, for kidney failure, that would be, that's a different story. So I think there is that. And unfortunately, we do have these disclosure requirements so that physicians, when they speak, have to say if they have received funding from drug companies. I often encourage patients, you know, if they're one sort of my rules of thumb when they're Googling is if you're on a website that is advertising the thing they're talking about, that's not the best website for you. And that holds true whether it's a supplement or whether it's a pharmaceutical product. You know, the pharmaceutical website's going to have a lot of information and most of it's going to be factually accurate because they're legally bound to be factually accurate. But clearly, you know, there's a lot of pretty pictures and smiling faces in the background. So you want some independent people to discuss the results of any trial.
The elderly couple sitting in bathtubs on Big Sur looking at the water.
Exactly, right? And then the list of side effects, you know, 500 things deep in small print next to them.
I don't know. That whole bathtub scene looks pretty good to me.
I'd take it if I had any free time.
Fortunately, we keep you too busy.
Right.
What about abject fraud? I mean, is there really ever fraud in research?
That's a great question. There undoubtedly is, because there are known cases of fraud. The question how prevalent it is a different question. And some surveys that have asked, you know, when you ask people directly, have you committed research fraud? Believe it or not, the answer is often no. But when you ask research associates and study coordinators, do you believe that fraud has ever been conducted? The numbers are higher, and numbers, you know, the yes response to that question sometimes as high as 20% in some surveys. I don't think that's the rate of abject fraud. It's hard to commit a fraud. So I'll give you my favorite example because this touches on the media. So in 2001, there was a randomized controlled trial in Korea. And they took women who were undergoing in vitro fertilization, trying to get pregnant, and they randomized them to usual care, which is just whatever happens in vitro fertilization. And the other group was prayer. And it wasn't the women praying for themselves. They sent pictures of the women to prayer groups in the United States.
Oh, right. Okay.
And had the prayer groups in the United States kind of pray at these pictures. They didn't know the women's name. They couldn't contact them. The rate of successful pregnancy was about 30% in the control group, which is decent, actually, for in vitro fertilization, 60% in the prayer group, which is
amazing.
Amazing. If there was a drug that did that, it would be a blockbuster. And, you know, prayer is cheap. So this got a headline in the New York Times, a study links prayer and pregnancy. The lead author or the senior author in the study was a guy named Rogerio Lobo, the then chief of OB-GYN at Columbia University,
which is
my alma mater, actually, for med school. But there's something a little strange here. And shortly after the study was published, it all fell apart. The interesting story is that the study never happened. It was completely fabricated. The women in the in vitro fertilization clinic were never found, nor were the prayer groups in the United States. The guy who wrote the study was a guy named Daniel Wirth, and he was later prosecuted on check fraud. He had been collecting his deceased father's Social Security checks for about 10 years. He went by the alias, and this is the best alias I've ever heard, John Wayne Truelove. Okay. This was a guy, he didn't have an MD. He had a JD, so why he's writing this medical paper is unclear. And as you look back, you see all these red flags. This is a great example of how peer review can sometimes go wrong. So peer review, we think, is this beautiful thing where we have an independent arbiter say, is this study good or not? But if you're just going to lie, I would look at that study and say, well, it's a randomized trial. That's the highest
good
quality
enough.
Of evidence. That's good enough. So we do need to be skeptical, especially about claims that are particularly fantastic.
Dr. Perry Wilson is an assistant professor of medicine at Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions, the address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and past editions of the program are available in audio and written form at yalecancercenter.org. I'm Bruce Barber, reminding you to tune in each week to learn more about the fight against cancer here on WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.